Welcome back to the Fairness Doctrine, left right radio for the Radical Center on WDISAM and WNSHAM. Call in and talk to us and talk to our guests, 508-384-8255. That's 508-384-8255. Well, the Texas Board of Education has once again reignited the battle in our society over what knowledge should be transmitted to the next generation. This year, they've decided to marginalize Americans like Thomas Jefferson to give the spotlight to their personal political heroes like Phyllis Schlafly, sending the message that ideas and books that created the greatest democracy in world history are secondary to narrow ideologies. But embedded in the acrimonious debates in Austin is a deeper battle over where American culture is going. And is it still, and should it always be, a product of Western thought, of the ideas that sprung from the Greeks and the Romans and evolved through Europe? Well, as immigration mixes those who studied Plato and Aristotle with those who learned the Upanishads and Carlos Fuentes and the Ramayana and the poetry of Rumi, the question becomes even more pressing. Should American cultures be based on the great ideas and the books of Western culture? Dr. Diana Sheets says yes, it should, and quickly. She argues that a cultural relativism, feminization, and the Internet have pushed aside the writers and thinkers that defined our culture. She argues for a return to the imaginary library of Western writers and the great conversation about Western ideas that animated education in America until the 1960s and animated my education. Diana Sheets holds a joint research scholar appointment at the Departments of English and History at the University of Illinois. She maintains a renowned literary website, Literary Gulag, devoted to criticism and political commentary, as well as some of her fiction. And she's author of great books on cultural identity, The Rise and Fall of Western Memory and Its Implications for Our Time, and many other books and articles on this topic. Diana, welcome to the Fairness Doctrine.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here, Patrick.
Well, we're happy to have you, but I have a question for you.
Okay.
In your article, you say that the culture wars undermine the cultural and historical foundations of Western civilizations. Could you explain, first of all, what you mean by the culture wars of the 1960s, and secondly, why did that undermine our cultural and historical foundation?
Well, the culture wars are the fundamentally different perspectives that that have really come to existence and I guess largely divided the liberal and conservative points of view. But in terms of the great books, I think that my focus would be on how cultural relativism and identity politics and what I call femininity have really undermined the values of our great literature. And and putting all cultures instead of, in front of our culture, and putting all identity politics in front of a shared identity, and putting the values of nurturance over the values of truth. These are the principles that I feel have undermined our culture.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit.
Okay,
because there's a lot of things in there. First of all, feminization. I'm not quite sure what you mean by feminization, and is that different than feminism, and is that different than what we've seen recently in the New York Times Magazine, others, that women are coming to the fore in universities and other institutions in our society?
Okay, so I make a distinction between feminism and feminization. And I define feminism very narrowly to mean the right of women to be paid equally for their work as men. So in terms of feminism, I have no problem with that. I think all people should be paid equally in terms of what they do. Now, feminization is in some sense a byproduct of women having become assumed a major role in the workplace and in academe, and it's quite different. What it says is that women's values, the values of a nurturant parent or the values for children, should be at the center of everything. And this I take objection to. I'm not in favor of putting the values of I'm a good person, I'm a virtuous person, the whole world should be virtuous, ahead of the pursuit of truth and knowledge.
We have a number of times had an author on this program, Rhianne Eisler. Do you know Rhianne's work?
No, I don't.
The Chalice and the Blade.
I'll have to look it up. I don't.
She is a strong advocate for nurturing in society and points out that what you call truth is actually domination, that that Western culture and other cultures, too, have been based on the idea that certain people and certain concepts dominate others, that white people dominate non-white people, that humanity dominates the environment, that Christians dominate other religions, that the strong dominates the weak, etc. And she says that actually society ultimately will not survive if we don't introduce nurturing into it, because the greatest job in society is to raise the next generation. Now, it sounds like you would object to that.
Well, her views are certainly consistent with the political left. It's interesting.
She would object to that, I would point out.
Of course she would. But the notion of dominance, and if you don't have dominance, if you don't have the prevalence of one body of ideas over another, what you get in society and in science is you get chaos, which causes the heat death of the universe. You cannot have a society or a civilization where every value becomes equal. There is no way to resolve that conflict, and the society literally dissolves. So, and of course, the left would like to think that the assertion of power or one truth is a bad thing. I think as a society, we need commonly shared views. And it doesn't mean that we're not open to other cultures, other ways of living, but you have to have a bedrock or a foundation from which to go out and look at the world.
Well, I would very much agree with your assertion that a society needs a set of commonly shared views. I live in California. There is no majority race in California, and we are a constant collision of different cultures and different languages and different societies, and also of different values. But within that constant clash and of those different elements comes a vibrant creativity, which is why Silicon Valley is here, not in Kansas, and no insult to Kansas there, but it's when you bring all those things together and they do interact and they do interchange ideas and thinking, and when you are open to other cultures. It's in my setup here, I mentioned the Upanishads and the Ramayana and the poetry of Rumi and other values and other writers and other cultures. You begin to see that while you do need a common language and a common set of values throughout a culture, Western or Eastern or Middle Eastern values aren't necessarily all right. They all have problems. And only by looking at other cultures and other values can you understand what problems you may have in your own and how to deal with them.
Well, I agree with you. I think, look, we live in a global world, and America is, in terms of its ethnic composition, is very diverse. And it would be silly or ridiculous of me to say that we shouldn't be looking at these other cultures. And if you go to any community or any academic community, you're going to find it's a very rich, diverse environment. However, that doesn't mean that you can't have a set of values that, based on your cultural history, that frames your orientation, and then with those that you go out and examine the world. And that's really the argument that I'm trying to make.
Well, within that argument, I noticed that you included social justice as a threat to our history and our culture. I would argue that the United States has been one of the preeminent advocates of social justice, and that's one reason why, until recently, we have been one of the most popular and sought-after nations in the world, because we do care about justice. We do care about what happens to people. We just don't shove it aside like many other cultures do.
Well, the definition of social justice has been changing over time. What it used to mean was a determination on the part of Americans to treat people fairly. and to ensure that everyone had an equality of opportunity. And certainly, I am a very, very strong believer in that interpretation of social justice. However, since the 70s, the concept of social justice has radically changed, and it has changed from be fair to what I call redistributing resources of the society to ensure that those who are most disadvantaged assume the greatest proportion of benefit from the society. And so that's where I think that liberals and conservatives and people can disagree. What kind of social justice are you talking about? Are you talking about the fairness to compete in society and to earn your living? Are you talking about a massive redistribution of wealth in order to guarantee or ensure that certain members of the population can live as well as others?
I do agree with you on that, and there has been that change. And I'm very happy that you bring up that nuances. We do have people who come on, and they don't see the nuances in that. And I'd like to unpack that a little bit, too. The notion of fairness and equal opportunity, of course, is the bedrock value of the United States, and that's one reason why people die to come into this country. And that's why people do come into this country, and they can do things here that they can't do anywhere else. And that's why where I live, and I think we're probably where you live, there are thousands of immigrants who were here with nothing and now run businesses, some of them quite large. But this notion of social justice also includes a recognition that there are systems and institutions within our society and also some cultural norms within our society which do their best to deny people access to equal opportunity, sometimes for selfish reasons and sometimes for cultural reasons. We fought a civil war over that. And then we went through the Jim Crow period, and we're still fighting in some places against that kind of discrimination that seeks to deny not social justice, but fair opportunities. And women have been one of those victims. Gay people have been one of those victims. Non-white people have been one of those victims. Immigrants, non-Protestant people throughout our history. We've always had institutions and cultural norms within our society which have sought to deny fairness. And I would argue that the move for social justice does have some desire for redistribution. I have to go along with that. And when Chuck and I went to see the movie Precious, we walked out of there saying the welfare system is definitely has serious problems. But the basis of it is fairness. It's people deserve the right to the same opportunities as everyone else, regardless of who they are. And these institutions and these cultural norms in our society need to be pushed back so that people can have equal opportunity. I'm not saying that we should give things to people. I'm saying we should allow people opportunity. And I think that's pretty much a progressive viewpoint.
And it depends on how you, of course, define allowing people opportunity. I think, of course, you want to have everybody have an opportunity to compete and succeed in the world. And I think the biggest debate is how much do you allocate in terms of resources, and particularly the greatest thing that can change people's lives is education. And so then the big debate or question or battleground becomes how do you allocate resources of education to ensure that those who are disadvantaged will have an opportunity to really make a contribution in society. But I think the big proponent of the change was John Rawls and his theory of justice, and he was at Harvard. And his what was interesting is while he allowed for equality, the mainstay of his argument was to make sure that there would be an unequal distribution of resources for those who are the most disadvantaged. And that's really where I have questions and concerns about why that should be part of the framework for social justice.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up education, and of course that brings up Brown versus the Board of Education, et cetera, which was an attempt to see to it that educational resources were fairly distributed. But I want to get back to something that you said in your article, and that is that the purpose of education is to transmit great ideas and values throughout society. I would say no, that's not correct. That and maybe it's because I was a professor at an engineering school, but from the point of view of students and the point of view of many, many, many of our donors, the purpose of education was to create a skilled labor force and to get a job.
Right. Well, that's certainly, you know, keep in mind, I believe you're teaching at Georgia Tech, and
right.
It has an engineering orientation, and so that's certainly going. Look, everybody is worried about that. What all students are concerned about today is when they get a job, how will they compete? But it's sort of interesting. If you look at the great books and Robert Hutchins' argument, it's fundamentally different today. It was the notion that to be an educated person and to be competitive in the world and in order to make a contribution in the world, you had to have an understanding of your culture, and you had to be able to communicate that in it, and have it interact with your daily business life. And the two should intersect, and they should have common ground. And I think it's very important that students not just get a trade education. I think they need to understand the foundations of their civilization and how this intersects with other cultures, in addition to having the skills they need to compete.
Oh, well, we absolutely agree with that, which is why I was asked to teach political science to engineers.
Right.
Right. And I also was raised on Hutchins' ideas of the great conversation, and I had wasn't an imaginary; it was a real bookshelf library in my room when I was a young person before I even went to high school. So I agree with you there. I want to move to Thomas Kuhn.
Okay.
And for our listeners who may not have gone to MIT and been forced to read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Thomas Kuhn is a professor at Harvard who put forth a theory on how new knowledge is created, and it's essentially new knowledge is created by ideas that are outside of the current structure of knowledge, and they have to fight for a while until they're accepted. It's a theory of constant destruction and recreation. And I would say that you cannot have, and first of all, I would say that most scientists pretty well agree with the structure of scientific revolutions. And I would say you can't have those kinds of revolutions if you don't have a constant flow of new ideas, new cultures, new values going through your society. And that's one reason why still the United States produces more patents and more PhDs than almost every other country in the world, because we do have this ongoing flow of new thoughts, and we do allow for this destruction and recreation.
Well, you know, I think the notion of the imaginary library or a canon is very interesting. It's not set for all time. The notion of what you might consider the great books is going to vary over time, and it has to allow for the contributions of new ideas. And I think that's very important to a vital society. But you also have to make determinations about what's worth keeping. I'm married to a scientist, and I'm surrounded by scientists, and I'll just tell you, many of them do not hold Thomas Kuhn in great regard. In fact, they regard him as a rather poor physicist who then went into the humanities and politicized wrongly science. So I'm not a fan of Thomas Kuhn. The things that you've mentioned, of course, we want to allow for change. We want to allow for the fact that that there can be this dynamic element that will cause the culture to reevaluate what it was and what it is becoming. But I think the interesting thing for me is that when I left academia and then came back after almost 20 years, is that for me, academia and the educational values had changed so fundamentally that it was almost unrecognizable to me that this was an educational institution. And I think for other people too. So Richard Bernstein, who wrote for the New York Times, wrote a book in 1994 called The Dictatorship of Virtue.
I remember that.
Right. And the reason is because he grew up, he was educated at Harvard, and he graduated in 1966, And at the time, humanities and scientists all had a core set of values that framed their great conversation, to use Hutchins' phrase again, and they could talk about a shared system of beliefs. And by the way, it was non-political. You could discuss Jefferson or Washington, and you could it didn't have to be political. But today, not only can they not have that conversation because they've never been exposed to it, it's been entirely politicized. So you can't sit down and have a conversation about the accomplishments or the failures of any of the great leaders that founded America.
Well, let's get into that. And you and I are very close on a lot of these things. And like I said, because I live in an incredibly diverse and dynamic state and an incredibly diverse and dynamic part of that state, I understand the need for shared values and the fact you do have to keep some things. What do you keep? How do you decide what to keep? What do you incorporate from outside, and how do you do that?
Well, of course, these are the questions that we will always be grappling with. I don't think there are any simple answers to that. But, you know, you'll read a book by a scholar on Lincoln, And the only things that you're reading about are the social injustices. You no longer have a sense of the courage of America or what it costs to try to align people toward a common vision. And it's really striking when you have someone like Drew Falpin Faust or whatever her name is, who's the president of Harvard, and her big study is about the suffering of the Civil War. And so these are the things that really bother me, is that there's no longer a sense of what the contributions were, and instead it's just a collection of injustices and miseries. And it's important to be aware of the injustices. It's important to right wrongs. But when all the great statesmen that founded America are reduced to sicknesses, then you really have a problem.
Well, let me take a stab at it, because both as a professor at Georgia Tech and currently in some other things I do besides this radio show, I deal with young people who have come to this country recently, mostly for educational purposes, and I could see quite clearly what they don't know about America. And because I've lived in other countries, I very quickly saw what I didn't know about those other countries. And I think the first part of this cultural literacy, if I can use this term, is first of all, you have to know some of the history of the culture you're living in. You have to know the heroes and heroines. You need to know the holidays and why they're the holidays. You need to know the religious backgrounds of, that is, if there's more than one religion, in some countries there aren't, in this country are, you need to know the major religions. You need to know how the political system works. You need to know how the business system works. And then you need to know how personal relationships work. Are they on the surface, as they are in the United States in many cases? Are they very, very nuanced and below the surface, as they are in some other places? And then lastly, you need to know the roles of different kinds of people, both gender, color, and point of origin, because different societies assign different kinds of people different roles. I would say that those make up what a culture is. And my definition of culture, incidentally, is a shared, learned, symbolic system of values, beliefs, and attitudes that shapes and influences perception and behavior.
And I agree with all of that, especially as the necessary tools to navigate a culture. My training is as a historian, and one of the great gifts to me in studying that discipline, it's not true anymore, but you were looking to understand why things happened and what the causal relationships were. And I don't think that's done anymore. And so in addition to all of the wonderful things that you've enumerated that should be part of gaining a basic cultural understanding, I really think you need to have a fundamental understanding of the history of that culture and what shaped it. And without that, you're just grappling in the eternal present, and you really don't understand the underlying motivations that drive us forward.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I mentioned history as the first part of that.
Yep.
Well, I'd like to take this back to politics, because this is a politics show.
Okay.
All right. And you do write about politics. I know you do. I don't know if you've watched any of the hearings on Elena Kagan's nomination to the Supreme Court. If you have, you may have seen her questioning by Jeff Sessions, in which he denigrated Thurgood Marshall to a certain degree. He called Thurgood Marshall an activist who changed our society in not necessarily great ways, and I think he may have been referring primarily to Board versus the Board of Education, Brown versus the Board of Education,
right.
And then later on some of Marshall's points. I would suggest that there are more than one culture operating in this country, and that there are at least two cultures, one of which is acceptance of change and of modernity, and a second culture which would like us to remain in some idealized world that ranges from 1950 to 1776. And that these two cultures have different histories. In fact, the Texas Board of Education is busy doing its best to try to revise our history. And they have different heroes and heroines, and they have different norms and values. And there's a constant tension, and that possibly what you're talking about, a common set of values, would help bridge those gaps. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think a common sense of values would help. I really don't agree with you. I think that obviously you would be ascribing the Democrats or progressives to being more acceptive of change and the conservatives to being more resistant to change.
In most areas, but not all.
Yeah. But I have a different notion of conservative or conservatism, and maybe it's an old-fashioned notion. It's about knowing what to preserve and how to utilize that for the future. And I think that what worries me about the society we live in, as we're living, as Christopher Lash noted, you know, back in the 80s, we're living in the eternal present. And I don't think we can be competitive in the world. And here's where I have a conservative worldview. If you take George Lakoff's notion of politics, the male view is the notion that we live in a dangerous world, and the nurturing parent or feminized view is that through social justice we will correct all wrongs. I would like to believe the feminized view. However, I do subscribe to the conservative view that we live in a very threatening world and we have to be strong. And part of the strength is knowing your history and emphasizing more a shared sense of values while acknowledging that, yes, we all have differences.
Well, I know George, and I think he probably understands the dangers in the world. I've never heard him denigrate that. But to your point about conservatives and Democrats and conservatives not wanting change and Democrats wanting change, actually conservatives, I think, actually want change. Current, and maybe I'm living in the eternal presence here, but to my point of view, conservatives are doing their best to change the safety nets that were put in place after the Depression. They're doing their best to change our democratic system by allowing corporations and labor unions and others to have unlimited amounts of money into it, and by doing so, completely changing our democracy. They changed the idea of defensive warfare under George Bush when they introduced the idea of a preemptive strike and struck actually the wrong country in that particular case, but that was something new. I think conservatives try to mask their radicalness, the radical changes they want within a public relations campaign saying they want to go back to value to basic values. I think they want to go back to the values they want, whether they're basic or not. And maybe that's just a political point of view.
Well,
and I'm going to give you the last minute.
Okay. I think we do, in a very real sense, have a culture war. We have two fundamentally different ways of looking at the world, and that shapes our values and that determines how we view things. And so I think conservatives have a different notion of where America should be than Democrats, and they're fighting to assert that worldview. And just as Democrats, and Obama is a prime example, is trying, they are trying to assert their worldview.
And that's what politics is all about. And unfortunately, this has been a fabulous conversation, but that's all the time we have, Diana. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Diana Sheets, University of Illinois. Read Dr. Sheets' essays at www.theliterarygulag.com. And stay tuned during the break, because when we come back, what a Fox reporter said about Sarah Palin, and is it true? I'm Patrick O'Heffernan, and you're on The Fairness Doctrine.